Welcome to Mind Styling, the podcast that explores how we can win at the game inside our heads and make a mark on this world in our own unique style, on our own terms.
We interview entrepreneurs and leaders who aren't afraid to push the boundaries and set their own definitions of success. We will share with you the tips and techniques they use to style their mind and give you the tools you need to start mind styling for yourself.
Hello, Mind Stylists. Welcome to another episode of Mind Styling for Entrepreneurs. I'm Dr. Becky Sage.
And I'm Amy Armstrong.
And we are so happy today to be joined by Olga Kravchenko. Olga is the CEO of Musimeo, an award-winning virtual reality educational platform that brings culture to children in a way that they enjoy the most by playing. The company's vision is to make arts and cultural education accessible to every child across the globe. Musimeo has received international recognition by winning numerous awards, being published in leading media such as the Financial Times, The Telegraph, etc., and working with leading cultural organizations around the globe. In 2019, Olga was awarded Women in Technology Scholarship by Sky, recognizing her as an emerging leader in the technology sector. Apart from running this exciting venture, Olga has been actively involved in helping other early stage entrepreneurs to start their business or transition into a tech career. Olga, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Becky, for such a kind introduction.
Well, it's incredible. I mean, there were so many bits I wanted to step in and be like, yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. but I thought I should just be professional and keep reading. So our first question for you is, could you tell us a little bit more about Musimeo and what your journey was to get where you are today?
Yes, that's a great question. And you know what, like I'm thinking more and more about where it all started. And it's really hard to pinpoint the exact moment when I had this aha moment. I can run a startup. It will be a high-tech startup around virtual reality. And I will completely agree and accept the fact that I will be anxious and nervous about the rest of my life because I'm now the startup founder. But yeah, I'll start by telling you about a little bit about Musimeo. So Musimeo is a virtual reality, or we call it an XR educational platform designed for children key stage two to fall in love with culture. And we do this by creating educational games that are based on different content, whether it's coming from a museum or from a publisher or from a charity, to help kids to broaden their horizons. What's also, I guess, is important part of Musimeo is a research-led approach. So we've spent almost a year working on a research case for Musimeo with over 3,000 kids, analyzing the effectiveness of virtual reality and how VR actually helps kids to remember more, but not in a way, oh yeah, I'm studying again, I'm at school, but in a way that actually excites them and they want to learn more and more and more. My favorite comment from an 11-year-old was, "Mom, can we do it all day at school?" That was the moment I was like, yep, we are doing something right. So that's a little bit about Musimeo, and the journey started, well, there are two starting points of my journey. I think the first point why I actually cared about how museums and cultural institutions are being presented to kids is because I am I'm a lucky sister of three other siblings, and the oldest one, who is now, we just turned 18, and it's really scary to be a sister of an 18-year-old, I can tell you. But back in the days, he was an 11-year-old boy, and he came to visit me in London. And I was so excited to see him and so excited to share my love and passion to culture, because I am a cultural geek. I love museums, I love theaters. And I was like, wow, an 11-year-old, he's definitely going to appreciate one of the Renaissance artists. So we're going to go to this exhibition and I'm going to make sure he falls in love with it. That was not the case. I just kind of a spoiler. We got into the exhibition. I actually took also a friend of mine with us. So I felt embarrassed because my little one was behaving like a horrible, horrible person. I thought so. Towards me by being like, no, I don't want to learn anything. I'm not interested. Can I just like go and connect to Wi-Fi and chat to my friends? And I was like, no, you're getting educated. Embrace it. I'm your sister. I'm your amazing sister. Embrace the fact that I am educating you and you will be a well-behaved man in the future. Clearly, the plan didn't work. He's a lovely boy right now, but back in the time after we finished the exhibition, after I finished the exhibition, because he just rushed through and left me with my friend alone in the exhibition space, I was really frustrated. I was upset. I was disappointed, not just in him, but also in myself, being like, why? Did I fail everyone? Did I fail my family not to be able to give this cultural love and passion to a little one? And I think thinking about this episode was probably pivotal for me, because later, after all the anger and frustration have passed, I was like, well, maybe there is something about how museum is actually trying to tell the story to an 11-year-old, and it's all written by art historians. And unless there is a specific reason for a child to go and learn things, he won't really enjoy it. And we just should accept it. And also, they learn in a very different way. They're digital natives. They're used to have everything at their fingertips. So why do I need to get frustrated with my little one? Maybe there is a way to make this information more exciting, more interesting. And that was, I guess, an unconscious starting point for Museumia, because it was way before I started doing my master's. And when I was doing my master's, I had a second episode when I was alone in Venice. It was after hours. It was like 9 p.m. I was in Palazzo di Venezia, and there was no people whatsoever. And I was like, wow, this experience is so special. I actually have this feeling that maybe some of the characters who used to live here are haunting the space. And I became obsessed about this idea of personalized museum, because I thought, okay, well, we can personalize theater, music, film, we can choose, but we can't really choose how we are consuming the information delivered in cultural institution. And that was kind of the little stepping stone for Museumia. And that's how it started. So that was the very, very beginning of the journey. That's how an idea came about.
Wow. I love hearing just all the passion and what pictures you're creating in our own minds. It's like, and I know that that's essentially what it is you're doing with your tools, with your products, you know, kind of creating those pictures. You do such a good job of it, even just telling us that story. It's incredible. Can I ask, what was your master's in?
So my master's was at King's College London in Arts and Cultural Management. And I never said it to anyone, and I can't believe I'm going to say it now, but I will. So basically, the idea started shaping up after this experience in Venice, and it was the very beginning of the term. And in my first year, I had this horrible professor who just kept on cutting me short whenever I was trying to bring the idea up, just to get some feedback from the class, because everyone was thinking in the same domain of the cultural entrepreneurship. And I think this tension between me and him actually made me feel even more excited and curious about how far I can take this idea. I had no business background. I had no technical background. It started for me with applying for a competition called Ideas Factory. Entrepreneurship Institute at King's is fantastic. They're doing incredible job in, I guess, helping people who might not have business background, or who might have business background but are not sure how to actually apply to the real world to pursue their visions and start companies, their accelerator. I've been through every single stage of their journey. While I was still in the accelerator, we were always making fun of the fact that I basically tapped in every single resource they have possibly planned for a student. But yeah, it all started with me applying for an ideas factory. I filed my application half an hour before the deadline. It was just a student competition where I had to pitch my idea. I was selected for a boot camp. I didn't win. And the prize was to be awarded in the Houses of Parliament. And I've never been in the Houses of Parliament, and I really wanted to be there. And I didn't win. I didn't make it to the next round. But this is the exact point where all the connections started flourishing. And yeah, if not this situation, I would not be where I am now.
I love this intersection of all of these different parts of you. It just feels like it's a natural blossoming from, a natural passion. But it's really interesting because when I was preparing, I was doing my research, I was being a good interviewer and going, wow, Olga's got an amazing CV. It was absolutely packed full of tech. So when did the tech come into it? Because you obviously had this passion for culture, this love of kids, this immense curiosity about the world and vision for how it could be brought to life more effectively. Where did the love of tech come in?
So I think that my love for tech started with my bachelor degree. I was doing a degree in drama, and I was focusing on the technical theatre as my domain, as my expertise. Everything to do with lighting, with sound, with the projection. I wasn't particularly good, don't take me wrong, but I was very much fascinated with how different tech elements, something that can be programmed in, can create this atmosphere and this feeling of magic on the stage. And I think the fact that there is just one person, or maybe three people, who are behind the controllers making the entire performance happen, to affect the lives of hundreds of people in the audience every given night, was just something absolutely inspiring. And I still don't understand how it actually happened, how this magic is being created from the tech to the actor to the actual audience member. So that's where my technology domain was. And after I was working as an event producer for some time, I was writing a beauty pageant called Miss USSR UK, and I'm not ashamed of it because it was a fantastic experience. And I think it was my first real life experience of how stressful things might get if there are multiple people involved and if you need to manage multiple people. So that's where my managerial experience is coming from. I was putting events that were quite small for around 200 people to something that was quite massive at a 3,000 people final. And most of the management of the team and stage management and making sure that technology works was on me. What was really interesting, and I guess when people talk about stress levels, I'm like, you should try stage management. Whereas when there are 40 people on stage, you should try stage management. There is no such thing as stress after you've been through that. and then when I initially pitched my idea at the Ideas Factory, I was connected with one of the most wonderful, amazing people I've ever met. And I think my love for technology flourished thanks to him. But at this point in time, Musemia was like a little baby. It was just like a sidekick idea that was just slowly brewing to become my full-time passion, I say.
So something I'm really interested in from listening to all those parts of the story that you've told so far is you seem to have this really good ability to make the most of opportunities and kind of to see them and then be confident enough to step into them. You know, even when you're doing your master's and you've got this person in a position of power, like there's a hierarchical thing there, and you're able to see that tension almost as a positive thing and not be quashed by it. What do you think it is that has built your confidence and given you that ability to get to see and step into opportunities?
I think that one of the most important skills in my life, I would say, is the ability to ask questions. If I'm actually interested in the subject, I will not
stop asking questions until I get to the point that I'm satisfied with the answer or it has satisfied my curiosity. And I had it since I was a child, since I was in my secondary school in Ukraine. I guess my parents helped me because they never discouraged me from asking questions. There were no difficult questions to discuss. I was never punished by asking any questions. So I think I naturally believed as a child, and I still believe, that I have the right to ask any question I want. And this is fundamentally what inspires me to go further, because as I find new information, it makes me want to ask new questions and more questions. And that's how I ended up being an entrepreneur. If I wasn't able to ask questions, or I would not be here, because when I was unsuccessful with my Ideas Factory first attempt, what I did, I remembered everyone I've seen on this day. And after, I went to the place where they were hanging out, that was Entrepreneurship Institute. And I just kept on saying, hey, do you mind just to talk to me? I have some questions. And I would not take no as an answer. I would ask you again and again and again until the point the person would be like, okay, it's easier to talk to you than not to talk to you. So tell me what you have to ask.
So you, it sounds amazingly resilient, because you're able to just keep pushing. How do you keep pushing? Where do you find that energy?
I think when I don't think about it, it's easier. I think that's the trick with the resilience. It's really easy to be resilient when you don't understand what might be the consequences about your resilience pushing forward. I think there was a lot of personal transformation happening from where I started my entrepreneurial journey, when I was this full energy 20-year-old being like, yay, I can do anything. I literally didn't think that there was anything impossible. It's like, there were just so many examples. And like, for me, I just needed the idea to spark in my head. And that was enough for me to pursue it to the point when it would happen, or when I would find a different idea I was more passionate about. I think when you're running a startup and your startup is maturing, it becomes a little bit harder, because suddenly you don't have responsibility just over your own passion and over your own, oh, whatever it takes, I will get there. You have a responsibility over a number of people who are working for you. Like, now we are a team of six, and I know that whatever idea I want to pursue, I also need to check it with what is reasonable, and to make sure that we have enough resources to keep going, or find the time to create more resources to pursue my idea. And I think that's when prioritization comes in, because you're like, okay, is it just something I'm going to think about for the next couple of weeks, and after I'm going to just burn out? Or is it something that will actually take our company further? Because the difference between Olga 5 years ago and Olga now, I have people to think about, I have company to think about, I have stakeholders to think about. When you start, you have this beautiful freedom of needing to think just about your own passion. And that's something I really miss, I guess.
Yeah, I found it very interesting, even when you were introducing it and you said, I don't really know, like back then before I signed up to, you know, I don't really know when I signed up to this thing. And I think probably more than anyone else we've interviewed, you and I have a similar journey. I mean, we've both done immersive tech in the education space, and it's very similar, I think. And that really resonated with me, what you said there. When did I sign up to this? Because I'm not really sure. I was pursuing my passion, I was pursuing some interesting things and kind of living my life, and then you've got all these responsibilities and that stress. And so I also, sorry for this being maybe a little bit more of a rambly question, I'm just exploring some ideas really, but also reflecting back to Amy's question about what kept you resilient to be able to keep asking those questions. And I guess it was because like you said, there wasn't really a consequence. You were just satisfying a curiosity. That's all that was happening there. Whereas now, the reason things do feel like there's more on your shoulders is because for you, you know, as an individual and the way you look at the world, there's much more at stake now. And you're the one who's in that position that has to hold it together. Is that a correct reflection? Is that something that rings true to you?
Yeah, definitely. It is a very correct reflection. And I think coming back to Amy's question, what kept me going before was curiosity. What keeps me going now is my team and my mission. And I think this is a very big difference, because where I am now in the journey, and I'm sure it will resonate with many founders, I'm not in a position to ask questions. Very often I'm in a position to answer the questions. And I think it changes the dynamic on how you pursue resilience and how you try to make sure you stay on top of things and don't give up, because again, stress, anxiety, everything else, it's the part of the package together with all the facts that entrepreneurship brings.
It seems to me like it's actually the case that the curiosity and the questions are where you derive energy from. Mm-hmm. And are there ways that you do implement that now in terms of problem solving with the team, or, you know, doing the things that you need to do? Think about how you can use that questioning and that curiosity to solve the problems that you have. Or, you know, I'm talking about problems. I don't really mean problems. I guess the challenges that you have to overcome as a startup. Is that something that you are able to employ, you think?
That's a very good question. Let me just think about it. I think, yes, I can still employ some of my curiosity, especially when I'm working with my technical team. So I'm not a technical founder. I went as far as completing Girls Code, Girls Code, the web development and the Python course, just because I wanted to be a little bit technical, and neither of these languages are actually applicable in Mesenia. But nevertheless, I have two certificates, so I can say I have some technological background right now. And with the questions, when I'm speaking to my developers or to my CTO, Alex, I always try to get to the very root of the problem. He would call me, it's like, something is not working, we are behind the deadline. I'm like, so why it is not working? When do you think you could have stopped the entire snowball to get us where we are right now? What could we do better? Can you explain to me exactly where it is in the code? And it's like, yeah, but you don't understand. I'm like, yeah, but I don't need to understand. All I want to right now is to know where is the problem. And once I receive the satisfactory answer, you can go back to fixing it, but I need to know. And I think this is similar behavior is encouraged within the team. One of our developers will challenge me on almost every single correction I would have to our experience, not in an aggressive way, but more just like, why? Can you tell me why we are making this decision so I can learn in the future? And then we wouldn't have this conversation again. And I'm always saying, I'm always closing any of our stand-ups with any questions, bad questions, good questions, simple questions, stupid questions are encouraged, because there is no right or wrong question to be asked. And this is a part of culture that I'm hoping to translate from the small team we are now to the big team we will be in the future.
Where do you get your sparkle from nowadays then? So you've got those questions. You've got a passion, I think. When you tell the story, you have a wonderful, wonderful storytelling capacity, actually, which I think is at the heart of the Mesenia vision. Where do you get the light that allows you to sparkle and just look forward to getting up and pushing on again for another day?
Oh, Amy, you're so sweet. the loveliest question I've ever heard. Thank you so much. So about my sparkle, I don't know. Like, I want to say something very practical. Sleep. I sleep a lot. I try to sleep a lot. I sleep 7.5 hours. If I didn't sleep for 7.5 hours, I will not function. It's like the day will be ruined. Like, people do not talk to me if I haven't slept for 7.5 hours. And I articulated that before starting our conversation. But on the more, I guess, metaphorical side of a sparkle, it's still the same thing that has driven me before. It's culture. It's the stories that the world has to tell. It's the fact that there are hundreds, thousands of stories being created at any given moment. We are speaking with you right now, and there are so many other conversations, so many other events happening that form the history of the humankind. So I think this fundamental belief that every single story is worth being told, and there is indefinite amount of stories, whether it's in the museum, in the theater, in the music, in day-to-day conversation, is what really drives me to continue pushing, to continue telling some of the stories that I find the most exciting, to make them even more interesting for the younger generation to nurture their curiosities. I think this is what really makes me want to wake up in the morning and continue doing what I do. And then when I lose it, because sometimes you have bad days, you have good days. Hearing the feedback that parents are giving us about how kids are using the experience is what makes you stop doubting anything you might have now. Like, if you're having issues with the fundraising, it doesn't matter, because there is at least one kid at any given point who is playing the game. And I think this is kind of like coming back to your own values, because one of my biggest values is a family. And I'm building Musimia partially to know that the world my future kids will live in will be full of stories, will be full of culture, will be full of curiosities. And I think having this feedback loop with all these kids who are contributing to us developing the game is, yeah, it's something that makes me feel alive.
Wow. There's a few things I want to pick up on in what you've just said. But first of all, I just wanted to reflect on how your energy shifted when you answered that question, actually. And it was no less passionate, but it was more grounded. So it's like, and I guess I'm reflecting on this because I really recognize it in myself as well. And I'm sure Amy knows I've said this about me, but that ability to kind of really sparkle. And you said, you know, you did a theater degree, like you understand being on stage, you understand that type of performance and sparkle. But there was something in the way you just answered that question that was really, there was a groundedness to the way you answered it. Actually, there was a weight to it that was even deeper than some of those other things that you just said, that came back to that real respect for the story, respect for humans and their stories and their journeys. And I thought that was really beautiful. And then the thing I wanted to come on to, which was about, which I think will be useful for a lot of our listeners, is coming back to this idea of being a tech founder but not with a tech background, and having this, the vision, the passion, the, you know, the respect for this work, and as you've just described, that you know who you're serving, and you understand, okay, that's the kind of impact I want to have. When I hear that story of that child having an amazing experience, that's driving me. And so for a lot of people out there, they may be in a position where they're not tech, they don't have a tech background either, but they really do have that impact that they want to make. Have you got any suggestions or anecdotes or anything about kind of what is it to be a non-tech founder? A tech founder, but without, you know, necessarily having that tech background. But as you've already described, you've upskilled and you've done some things to make sure that you are engaging and talking with that tech team. But for those who maybe are a bit like, oh, I'm a bit more frightened of the tech, but I really want to do this thing and I can see tech as an enabler to allow it to happen. Have you got anything you would say to those people?
That's a very good question. And during my times at Sky as a woman technology scholars, one of my responsibilities was to send a positive message into the community of young women and young girls who are considering pursuing the tech career. And I think there was a lot of debate going on into what does career in tech actually means. And something that I'm always preaching is saying, stop telling women and girls to get into tech. Just tell them to pursue their dreams and show them how technology, as you rightly said, can work as an accelerator for their mission. And I think that's when we see a big shift into people actually not being scared of the word technology, not being scared that they're going to end up running into 100,000 loops of limitless bugs that you end up having in your code when you're writing the code. According to my CTO, I don't need to deal with it. But I think that there are two pieces of advice. I think it's really, it's feasible and it's possible to get to some level of seriousness with your venture if you're trying to build an actual tech business that requires deep understanding of technology when it's using VR, AR, machine learning, anything else that you cannot just prototype. But there is a myriad of things you can do as a non-tech founder to prove that when you find the right person to be on board with you as a CTO, as a contractor, whatever is the way you would want to do it, it will work. And I think this is when, like, I think there are two mistakes that early stage founders are making. They're looking for investments the minute they have an idea. And I'm like, this is just not going to fly. Like, this is just not, there are different ways to get the funding. But it's not that someone will just throw £100,000 at you when you initially came up with something you even haven't tested. And then secondly, a lot of people rush into trying to find a technical co-founder if they're not technical, not for the sake of building a venture together, but for the sake of trying to build something they have imagined. And the fundamental difference is that when you are looking for a co-founder, you're looking for a team member. Because, for example, my CTO is not my co-founder, but he is the key to Musemian. He's one of the most important people in my life. You need to treat them and their interests first before you treat your own interests and your own desire to exploit their skill set just to prove something to someone. I'm not sure if I'm making sense. Am I just rumbling?
I think it makes a lot of sense to me. And in some ways, I think it comes down to, you know, what really exploring the problem space, really understanding the problem space, really getting that vision and that idea. And, you know, this is something that I, you know, with a lot of the founders that I'm working with, and especially those who are in the tech space, I think, you're exactly right. I've seen this, what you've described again and again and again, which is this kind of, I think at the very core of it is that this kind of need to jump into a full solution very, very quickly and to completely over-engineer, want to offer every single idea you've ever had. I mean, I know I was guilty of this. Like, this is the thing. I can envisage this incredible thing. Now let's do it. And instead of kind of rolling that back and going, hang on a second, who are we serving? What's the problem space that we're really investigating here? Where is it that we fit? How can we prove out that this idea is going to work, or has a potential to work and has a potential to form into a business? Or it may not even be a business, but that's what you're, you know, exploring, I think, in your head. Mm-hmm. So you're not bringing people in under a fallacy. And I think, again, this comes into not romanticizing the idea of the entrepreneurial journey too, and just going out to those a CTO say, and being like, well, this is the next big thing, it's really exciting, so you should work for free with me for the next 3 years because then we're gonna all be billionaires. Yeah. So I think interestingly I was talking to one of my friends who was an investor, and he was saying that he has this, he's an investor, but he also kind of does mentoring and things like that. And so I wonder if you've experienced this too, and I've definitely experienced it, where he's had a lot of people who've come to him and have basically, he said it's kind of a 50-50 split with founders. Some of them are really humble and they're very like really respectful of his time and everything. And then he gets this other half who are like, well, you should want to work with us because this is an amazing idea and we're definitely all going to be rich. And why don't you give like ridiculous number of hours of your time to come and help us? And it's that kind of extreme. And so I think there's lots of ideas that you're exploring there. But I think that's kind of one of them is the thing of going, well, an idea isn't actually worth that much until you've done that exploration, until you've, you know, done, been out there, you've understood who you're serving and how you're serving them and what problem space you're filling. So yeah, it definitely makes a lot of sense to me. And Amy, does that, I'm sure, I know I kind of pulled out one thread from that just because that's been resonating with me recently, that idea of problem space and exploring it for longer, staying in it for longer. But I don't know if you had any other things that you pulled out of that as well.
Well, building a relationship based on trust and exploring that, really important. But I wonder if we just stay with this concept of how to, you have that amazing vision and then the reality of needing to pull back and work out where's the beginning of this journey and then how do we enjoy this navigation of this really important place, because actually you've got to build your venture on rock, not on sand. And it so often can feel as if it's shifting sands as a founder. And I was curious because you talked in glowing terms. It sounded like Mike was a really important person or juncture in your life and influence with Mementor. What was it that he brought to you at that stage that has really put you in such a good place now?
That's been a long time ago. Let me think about it. Well, I think my relationship with Mike, he was just incredible to start with. So as that's kind of the first observation. He was my first unofficial mentor. He gave me two things. A, he gave me the experience that I didn't have. And he was very straightforward with his feedback. If he was feeling that perhaps I could have done better at any given point, or there was something that was a little bit off, we had very open relationships. So we were never scared to share the feedback with each other. And then at the same time, I knew that if I was feeling like something he was doing wasn't necessarily right, I knew that even if I was much more junior than him, and I didn't have that much experience, neither in technology or running the company or running a startup or VR or AR or anything, my opinion will still be heard and respected. He also had incredible ability to build relationship with people. And I think all of these relations have been built on respect, of a mutual respect. When people would meet Mike, they would immediately respect him. He was very, very authoritative, like figure with a PhD in machine learning and biomedical engineering. No, something else. I don't remember it right now. It was a part of my pitch, but I don't remember it because it was a while ago. He was this very impressive, authoritative figure. And whenever he was trying to start a conversation with someone, he would always bring this respect and self-respect with him into the room. And that's why all the relationships that he formed has served him quite long term. And I think this is one of the most important qualities and skills, I hope, I still don't know, I learned from him. And even though we have fundamentally different characters and different energy levels, I'm still hoping there is a bit of Mike in me sometimes when I'm meeting new people, when I'm trying to present myself, present the company, because it's all about, I'm here because I want to be and I respect my time and your time. And if you're here to do the same, I think we'll get along. I think this is kind of the mantra in my head when I think about Mike.
Fantastic. So he sounds like, yes. So again, this comes back to relationship. And then you've beautifully brought us back to the present then and your relationship, for instance, with your CTO and the rest of your team. And that really, I really like that distinction you make. So respect, but self-respect too. And I think that's so important, that just calm, grounded, centered, I've got this. And I believe you've got this. So how do we work adult to adult together to find the next step, to find the way forward?
I was wondering about, well, first I was just going to reflect that. I wonder if that comes from this, comes back to the curiosity thing, because you're curious and you're asking questions. You're able to be like, well, this isn't about me. This is about being curious about things. And that allows you to kind of strip a bit of ego or whatever it might be. The question I wanted to ask was around your, that kind of self-esteem thing, and that whether that's something that you've always been able to kind of keep relatively high, and as you've kind of moved through all these different roles, these different businesses, because what you have described has been some really strong relationships and strong decisions that you've been able to, or strong paths that you've been able to follow, and continue to be yourself all along the way. And I wonder if that really is the case, or is that just that we've kind of heard those parts of the story. And if so, are there things that kind of knock your self-esteem, or are there doubts that you have, and what sort of things trigger those doubts?
Oh, that's a very deep question, Becky.
I should have carried on talking, shouldn't I, Olga?
You obviously only answer at a level that you want to answer. We're not asking you to kind of spill your whole life, but just in terms of, I guess, other listeners listening in, wanting to go, wow, it just feels like Olga's got everything made. She's like sorted. Well, she knows how to do it.
That's kind of like, no. So obviously there are plenty of moments in my life, both professional and personal, when I don't feel that I'm in control. And that's usually what undermines my self-esteem. I think that generally the way I was brought up, and again, I'm coming from a East European country called Ukraine. I know it's a huge country and everyone knows about it, but I guess the mentality there can still be quite different to the mentality that is adopted in most of European countries. Something that I've been mentioning to someone a while ago, that we don't necessarily, even when we're kids, we don't have a lot of compassion available to us when we feel sad or when we feel down. So naturally, you develop these coping mechanisms that allow you to be the version that you're most comfortable with on day to day. So I think that's one aspect of the story that is very personal, because, again, I spent the first 16 years of my life in Ukraine. Most of my most conscious and unconscious beliefs have been formed during these times as well. And secondly, so just I will linger here a little bit longer. So as I said, you deliver this self-coping mechanisms, and when quite early in my life, I became very interested in all the self-help books I could get. And I was very, very keen. Like whenever I would feel sad, I would just buy another self-help book and read it and get myself out of this feeling of not feeling my best or not feeling very comfortable with myself. So I managed to hide a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings that were probably rooted in the fact that, yeah, I couldn't be 100% high energy, high self-esteem all the time, but I didn't really want to accept it. Only in the last 2 years, with the help of the coach, of a number of coaches and mentors, I managed to come to terms with the acceptance that not every day is my day. Not every day I will feel 100%. And as long as I know it will pass and tomorrow will be a better day, I can just accept these feelings and move on. Not hide them, not try to suppress them, but actually accept the situation, allow myself to be a little bit kinder to myself and go further. So I think that's kind of the long answer to your self-esteem questions. And I don't like speaking about imposter syndrome because I think it's just a very over-talked subject and people always talk about it. Everyone has this moment and it's normal to feel this way. And as long as you know how to deal with these low self-esteem moments in a productive way, if you need to do it at a very given point, like if you have a presentation or a meeting or something like that, and you cannot afford just to sit there and cry in the corner because you feel like just feeling bad for yourself. If you know these techniques, then you are okay and you can be as vulnerable as you want in the world.
So you've developed or added into your natural curiosity compassion.
I tried.
Yeah. Compassionate curiosity and learning to be kind to yourself. I love that idea of Olga, the teenager, devouring all these self-help books. What's your favorite self-help book?
Oh, I love Carnegie. I love Dale Carnegie. I think he is incredible. And one bit of the self-help book that I will always remember, and I'm always using, like, honestly, this is the best way for me to deal with my anxiety moments. Imagine the worst possible situation, like the worst. So immediately when I'm having a challenge, I'm like, this is the worst outcome that we can get. It's very unlikely we're going to end up in jail or dead. So we're fine. It's like, and this is not the most positive self-help technique, but it's super effective. And once you're like, okay, I can deal with it. I can figure it out. Not going to end up in jail. Not going to die. Fine. Move on. Next.
I love the way you say that. It was actually our very first top tip on the Mindstyling podcast. It was Zara's episode. That was her top tip. What's the worst that can happen? Yeah. And she just... that's where we started. Although Amy and I did have a chat about the fact that we can sometimes think of really bad things that can happen.
But and if you're that person having a complete meltdown prior to your presentation, you will be very much in charge of all the worst things that can happen. It'll be front and center. Well, Olga, you strike me as someone who actually is very comfortable leading a meeting or a presentation or a pitch. But what would your tips be for those people who do find those moments tricky?
Well, I think that my confidence in leading pitch or a presentation comes also from my theater background. So I think there is another little bit that we share with Becky. And also I used to be on cheerleading team, so there is another bit of synergy. So basically when I, Becky, the first time I've seen you on stage, I was like, I think this is me, but I'm pretty sure it's a different person.
I was actually thinking about that in the lead up to this conversation where I was like, yeah, I kind of like, how are me and Olga so similar, but born in different places, slightly different times.
I just found it very interesting. It's like acting, gymnastics, VR, educational startup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of similarities. All the things we've described with like energy and groundedness and having to be okay with the not okay days, like everything. There's a lot of similarities there. Sorry, Amy, there's two of us today.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right. And I am a stage manager through and through. So I got that one, that analogy from the start. So what has this wonderful performance training given you?
Yeah, thanks. Sorry.
Well, just given you that enables you to just be able to enjoy those moments of performing, I suppose.
Thank you for this question, because this is not the question I'm usually being asked. And I think that the answer here is I've been on stage in front of people who actually paid to see me so many times when I was younger, because I was working in the theater from the age I was 13 to the age I actually went to the UK, that whether you are scared or not, you end up having this mechanism to basically just switch on when you are on stage. And this basically became a habit. So I would say practice, practice, practice. And if you are really struggling with a fear of presentation or a stage fear, I would encourage you to try to combat this fear in a more relaxed setting, such as special improvisation classes. They're even available online. You don't even need to show your face. You just need to sometimes say something. So there is improv classes that you can take that are incredible. Stand-up comedy is fantastic, and it's also the way to really get to know you. And really working on your pitch, if this is the biggest difficulty you're having. With my co-founder, when we were preparing for the pitch at the beginning of our journey, we would write it down, we would learn it by heart, and after we would repeat it so many times next to the mirror and in public. Like, I actually made Caitlin say again and again the lines from our pitch while we would be going to a place where we would pitch out loud at full loudness on the tube or just walking on the street. And it usually helps because you and I'm sorry, my dog is barking.
He's cheering us on.
You end up, your muscles and your muscle memory ends up remembering every single word. So all the stress and all the nerves just go away. And it's a fantastic practice. So repetition is your little helper if you're scared of the stage. And another bit that I find very helpful to free yourself from any kind of stops or a natural way of pitching or delivering the presentation is delivering in a very artificial way. When you just make really big moves and you try to shout or speak quietly or have unnatural pauses or something that feels so unnatural that whatever you do after will actually feel natural.
I love that. Well, I love all of those tips. And that last one is definitely a technique that has helped me. Because, of course, like you said, in theatre training, that's what you do. You kind of, or sometimes that's how you would workshop things. Like, you take them to an extreme and you kind of play about with it and you play with it so much. Actually, coming back to this theme of play, I suppose, in some ways, you're really pushing those words and it takes away from that kind of that. Of course, what you're saying is important, but it's not as like, it doesn't feel as stressful anymore because you've played with it in all those different ways and you're so familiar with it through that play. So I think that's, yeah, awesome tips. We need to wrap up, but Amy, do you have any other questions before we get to the final question?
Well, yes, I have one. Okay. Because there's learning your script and there's improvisation and there's that confidence that you can speak from your script. So when a vet investor asks you a tricky question, which perhaps you aren't sure of the answer of, how do you hold it together? How do you keep that calm, yes, access to muscle memory to know, to actually know I've got this and I can explore it? Any top tips there?
That's a fantastic question. And I think that's the one that most of the startup founders dread the most as well. But I think there is a very easy way to address it. And it usually helps you in 99% of the situation. You need to workshop the potential questions that might be coming. And you kind of, when you run through your pitch, you know what are the weakest slides. You know what are the numbers that probably going to cause a couple of questions. So it's very easy to self-workshop it and be your own most horrible judge in this situation and give yourself so many horrible questions that you can answer them once and forever, and then there will be nothing that will put you off guard. Or you can always ask for a fellow startup founder. Don't do it with your friends. They will just tell you you're amazing, and that's just not helpful. Someone who is in a startup world who is not a very close friend, but someone who is hopefully a professional friend in this situation to give you honest feedback and to give you questions as if he would want to invest £10,000. And I think that would give you a nice understanding of like good improvisation is always a prepared one. So
thank you. Really wise.
That's so useful. I love that final quote there. Good improvisation is always a prepared one. It's the idea of how are you how prepared are you when you showed up. Don't run away from those things that are the challenging areas. Like, actually lean into them and prepare for them, and be okay with not always having an answer as well. I think in startups, if you had everything you needed to be 100% confident about your business and to be completely like, this is where exactly I wanted it to be, you wouldn't necessarily need to be going and doing those pitches and asking for everyone. So I think also being able to say, well, this is where we are now and we aim to do this, or we're going, you know, but actually we don't have the full answer to that question yet. And that's part of the next phase of the journey or whatever.
And I think there was something else that you mentioned earlier in the podcast. You were talking about humbleness of some founders and this skill to accept and to feel comfortable with the fact that we don't know everything and we don't need to lie and we don't need to come up with some fairy tales that we are hoping will persuade someone we are more than we actually are. And I think this is very funny, because when you're early stage, and that's what I see a lot, most of the early stage founders think they know everything and they don't. And I think by the point you reach this tipping point when you're like, actually, I'd much rather say I don't know than continue making myself a fool, that's when the real startup maturity comes in. So I highly recommend this experience to every single early stage founder.
Yeah, I definitely resonate with that as well. So we're on to the final question. You've given us loads of tips already, so I'm not sure if we've taken up, like if we've already taken all your tips from you. But if you were to have one top tip for aspiring entrepreneurs or, you know, people in the startup space, what would it be?
So there is a classical answer that I always give is just do it, because it doesn't matter if you fail. If you try, this already counts. But this is a very generic advice. And to be honest, when you're just starting, this advice is not applicable like at all, because you're just scared to fail. The actual practical bit to all early stage founders would be, don't be afraid to follow up with people you haven't spoken in a while. Because when I'm looking at people that we've contacted as a company 2 years ago, when we weren't even a startup, that we were just an idea that had some validation, and they rejected me, or they weren't that positive towards the idea, they gave me a lot to think about and they helped me to get where I am now through their negative constructive criticism. I think negative constructive criticism would be an exact definition of how I treat it now, but then it was just negative criticism back in the days. Mm-hmm. And ask for new tips and for new help, because if these people are still relevant to what you're doing today, they would probably be so much more impressed by your progress on what you've actually done, rather than remembering that perhaps you didn't perform well 2 years ago. So never be afraid to go back to these people who initially has given you a negative constructive criticism.
That's such a good point. And I just think back to all those times where I was like, oh, I don't know if I should message that person, because like I haven't messaged them for a really long time, and you know, and did they even, they didn't even like me, like, and again, like me, it wasn't even to do with me, it was to do with the idea. And actually what I've found out either through the grapevine or just going back to those people in other situations is what they were actually saying behind the scenes was, oh, this is really promising, this is really good, oh, like Becky knows her stuff, or whatever it is, that company is really strong, and I love this part of the idea. And at the time I hadn't really realized that was what was happening. So I think that that's a really amazing tip, and just so grounded in the reality of those feelings we have as founders, as entrepreneurs. So I think it's brilliant, and just says a lot about the journey that you've had and the experience that you've had already, that you can give such a specific and useful tip. So thank you very much. It's been great to talk to you, Olga.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun. I love meeting Amy.
Thank you so much. It's been brilliant. I feel like we've really uncovered some really valuable tips that can be genuinely applied.
Hopefully it can be useful to someone who is listening to this podcast. And if it's not useful, let me know.
But it's not just for entrepreneurs. I think it's really important for everyone who's aspiring to be their best selves.
Yeah. And so if there are people out there, let us know. Do you agree? If you've got any feedback for us, you can get in touch with us. There's all the links in the show notes to both our work and to Olga's work. And we'd be really happy to hear. And are these tips useful to you? But also, if they're not, or if they're not things that apply to you, then this is about a conversation. This is about telling stories and different people's stories, different people's perspectives. So we really, really would love to hear from you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Olga. It's been brilliant.
Thank you.
So we can't always control the situations that are going on outside of us, but we can be in control of how we react to those situations.
And that is what mind styling is all about.